This is Ed Rippey, and I'm here with Alex Hastings. Thanks so much for joining us here today. Alex and I head up the e-discovery practice at Covington, and we have these webinars periodically, as many of you know. They're for our clients, and we really take your requests seriously. So, for instance, today's duty to preserve topic, that's by client request. It's also something we get an enormous amount of questions, every month. This seems to be a hot topic. So we're covering that. If you have requests for future topics you want us to cover on a webinar, by all means, just shoot us an email because we do it. And we're going to talk about the duty to preserve. Like I said, we get a lot of questions directly from you clients. We also get them internally from our fellow colleagues here. So it seems to be, annually a hot topic. We're going to talk about, we're going to focus on when it ends. You know, a lot of people talk about when the duty preserve starts, but we find that we get more and more questions about when we can lift a hold. We're also going to talk about preservation in the context of what are truly hot topics, backup systems, cell phones, and IM. And then we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, subpoenas and when you're a third party, do the same rules apply to you? The short answer is not really. So that, let's start with part one. And I'm going to let Alex lead this section.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ed. This is Alex Hastings. So we'll dive in here to discuss the duty to preserve, and starting at the beginning, when does the duty to preserve arise? I think it's pretty well settled, and most people, I would imagine, understand that the duty to preserve arises when a litigation is reasonably anticipated, when an investigation is reasonably anticipated. In some jurisdictions, it's when it's imminent. The test, though, for when the duty to preserve arises has been the subject of much discussion. In searching case law, there are many opinions discussing when the duty to preserve arises. That's not going to be our focus so much today as when the duty to preserve ends. And the question of when the duty to preserve ends has unfortunately not been the subject of the same amount of jurisprudence. So there's actually very little case law deciding when the duty to preserve ends. And taking this small amount of case law and combining it with a very fact-specific inquiry makes this question a somewhat difficult one. And we're going to address this in more detail. Ed's going to discuss the factors that go into ending the duty to preserve. You know, has the litigation ended? Has the investigation ended in a settlement? Are we confident that the matter is over? But also considering, are there other parties that might bring similar claims or have similar causes of action? Or in the investigation context, are there agencies that may take an interest in the conduct that was under consideration? So all of these issues sort of go into the question of when the duty to preserve ends. Which we'll get into in some detail. But before we do, we wanted to make a process point here at the outset, which is before a company finds itself asking the question of when can we end the duty to preserve, it's important to have processes in place that ensure that a litigation hold can be lifted safely and effectively. And there's really two sources to look here. One is the legal department and whether there's a process in place for assessing whether a duty to preserve has ended and a legal hold can be lifted, and whether there's a process in place for documenting that hold. A lot of times outside counsel is involved in that decision to help provide justifications that down the road, if there's questions as to why the company lifted a hold, that decision is well documented. But in addition to the IT department, we often recommend making sure before, you know, arriving at the decision of lifting a hold that there's proper processes in place in the IT department. And this is important for a couple of reasons. First, the IT department needs to understand the sort of the intricacies of lifting a legal hold. So, for instance, if a legal hold is lifted for a custodian for one matter, the IT department needs to make sure that they're not affecting the legal holds for that same custodian that might be in place in other matters. So, you know, We've seen this happen before where a custodian, where the IT will turn auto delete back on for an email system for a custodian because one litigation hold has been lifted, but there might still be other litigation holds or legal holds that are in place for that custodian. And so, processes have to be in place to make sure that litigation hold that can be lifted is lifted in sort of a surgical fashion. But also there's a practical consideration here, and that is when you start lifting holds for custodians, we've experienced that it can catch some custodians off guard, so they get used to being able to retain everything they have, not having their emails automatically deleted, not being subject to the document management policy of a company, and then when their legal hold is suddenly lifted, it can be frustrating for the custodians because they haven't been archiving their documents like they should have been, and now they're potentially gone. So turning to the next slide. Okay, so unnecessary holds, I think it's pretty clearly understood. Increased legal risk, retaining documents, retaining emails that don't need to be retained unnecessarily, can unnecessarily increase an organization's legal exposure. And it can also lead to unnecessary costs. There was a survey that came out recently that said that, you know, a gigabyte of data storage per year can cost up to $20, which seems nominal, until you think about organizations that are retaining terabytes of data, and potentially unnecessarily retaining that data, that those costs can add up. But also, early removal, on the other hand, can result in serious sanctions, monetary sanctions, adverse inferences, at worst a dismissal. So there can be some serious sanctions. Now, the revised rules of civil procedure have offered hopefully some comfort, as they were revised about a year ago, to provide a little bit more uniformity when issuing these sanctions. I'll just pause here to talk about those amendments because I think it's helpful to provide a brief update in how they've been implemented, because I think it can color the decision of whether to lift a legal hold and whether the duty to preserve has ended. So Rule 37, as many likely know, is the primary source for sanctions for the spoliation of electronic information. Rule 37 applies only to parties, which is important for later in our discussion when Ed will talk about third-party subpoena recipients. Because they're not technically parties, several courts have found that those parties are not subject to sanctions under Rule 37. So there can be a good defense there if a third-party subpoena recipient is subject or faces a motion for sanctions for spoliation. But the federal rules were meant to, the amendment to the federal rules were meant to cause Rule 37 to create uniformity in two ways. One is to require courts or to guide courts to only issue sanctions to the extent necessary to cure the prejudice. So it sort of gives the guide as to how strong the sanction should be. But also, and I think a little bit more interestingly, the new rules also say that an adverse inference instruction, which can be a very serious sanction, is only available when there's been an intent to deprive the other party of data or of electronic information or of responsive documents. This latter point is important, that the limitation on the adverse inference is important, because we were seeing before the amendments to the federal rules sanctions for negligent conduct, so we were seeing adverse inferences just based on negligent conduct. So turning to the next slide here. So document management policies can be a good tool for managing legal holds, and they can be helpful both when legal holds are implemented, but also when they are being lifted. So with a proper document management policy in place, especially one that accounts for email retention and disposal, a party can have a strong defense of spoliation if a spoliation occurs. This is especially true if the spoliation occurs right before or right around when the legal hold is being issued. So usually we will, and very often we will advise companies to issue a legal hold as soon as the duty to preserve arises, not to wait for IT to start to, put things into order, but to issue that hold and get it out there. Now, while that's being done, there's inevitably, as a practical matter, a delay in stopping some of the systems. And if data is lost in that process, document management policies can be very helpful in putting forth a defense that there was no intent in this destruction, instead it was the normal operation of the computer system. Especially in light of the new rules, and again, going back to the adverse inference instruction that we were just discussing, courts have placed a new emphasis on document management policies under these rules and looking to see if there's an intent to deprive the party of data, or if it was just simply, the process that was normally in place under the document management policy that resulted in the loss of data.
On this last slide on the duty to preserve, I'm going to sort of, I would almost consider these to be some takeaway points. Just for starters, there's no, on, particularly on lifting a hold, there's no bright line rule, and I really mean this is fact specific. So we get questions around here all the time, like I said at the start, from you all, as well as from our colleagues here, and it gets very detailed about when is it proper to lift a hold. The easiest route would just be to have a stipulation with the opposing party. We're going to lift a hold. We no longer have a duty to preserve. That's a great theory, but in practice, it's hard. You know, if you're in a litigation, it's hard to agree on anything. If you're under a government investigation, they probably never want to say that you have no duty to preserve. So if you can get a stipulation, it's great, and that can be, you know, over and done with. If it's not possible, which is, I would say, you know, 95% of the time, there are a lot of things you're going to consider. So if you're on the litigation side, the first thing I'm asking someone when they raise this is, you know, well, is the litigation over and have all appeal rights been exhausted? Maybe there's a settlement that does away with appeal rights or allows appeal rights. So depending on, you know, how the settlement is or how the litigation ends, that's going to determine really when, you know, the case is quote unquote dead. So that's going to influence, you know, whether you think you no longer have a duty to preserve. I find that's a little, you know, more straightforward than, in the investigation context. So the investigation context to me can get really complicated really quickly. I'm a litigator, but I handle these issues in both the litigation and the investigation realm. This gets into gray zone quickly. So for instance, you know, there'll be an ongoing investigation and maybe it seems dormant because nothing has happened for 6 months. So someone will call up and say, look, it's been dead for 6 months. There's a related case in some other jurisdiction that settled and is closed. So are we okay on lifting the hold and going on our merry way? Well, it depends on, you know, all the circumstances, but you know, it might be, well, why don't you write to the government agency and ask them, is this really, are you done with us? And you can imagine that most clients don't want to do that. Like if the dog is sleeping, why wake it up? So there's a lot of strategic and factual circumstances that get batted around about when is it proper to lift the hold during an investigation that hasn't been like formally closed. In other words, your company hasn't gotten a letter that says, we are done with you. So there, for me, it's kind of a matter of timing and considering everything that's going on. Maybe if you're comfortable after, sometimes I'll tell people, why don't you come back to me in 3 months and tell me what's happened in the next 3 months. I'll say, well, nothing's happened. It's been 9 months now. Well, yeah, that seems like a long time. Four other cases have closed, and we heard from somebody that they're not intent on pursuing it, but they're not going to issue a letter. Then, you know, you might say, well, geez, you're still really not in the clear if you wait another 3 months. But it's that kind of, you know, balancing act when you're being investigated, but it seems like it's closed, but you don't have a formal letter. So that's a really long way of saying, in my opinion, the litigation front, you know, you can make a determination in, I think, fairly quickly on whether you're right to lift the hold, whereas investigation, it can get complicated quickly, and you should be careful on that front. Some things that we consider on whether to lift the hold are, for instance, related litigations. Are there litigations, as I mentioned, going on elsewhere in the United States or the world for that matter that concern, I don't know, similar product, the same agency, the same parties, similar parties? So if those are still going on, that would, you know, be one factor that you'd say, well, maybe we should hang on to our documents still. Another is industry-wide. So, for instance, there are many industries where we have many clients, and a certain industry starts getting picked on, and whether it's in the litigation or the investigation realm. And you have to, in those industries where I really do, I'm mostly on the defense side, but the industry is getting picked on. It's not really that fair, whether it's by private parties or by the government. That's where it's, you know, I would be more cautious in advising to lift the hold because you feel like, one client might be held indirectly accountable for transgressions of some other company. So again, if the industry or if the industry has a really good reputation for being completely compliant, not many problems, then maybe it would be easier to lift a hold when you're in that gray zone. We cite here on the next slide one case, In Re Ethicon. This is not, you know, particularly noteworthy except for the bullet points. There are a lot of cases like this, right? And, you know, if you want to get a better feel, I just put the site up there. We're not going to discuss it in detail, but it's a good sort of jumping off point if you want to take a look at that more. Somebody during this has asked if we could share the source of the survey that Alex had mentioned about the cost of retaining data, and of course we can, and what we'll do is we'll send that out along with the slides when we send them out to you all after this webinar. About backup systems, mobile devices, and IAM, you know, these, again, even outside of the preservation issue, we get a load of questions about these three, so we thought it would make sense to talk about preservation within these three. So I think Alex is going to start off with the backup systems.
Yeah, so there are several approaches to dealing with backup systems and dealing with whether to recycle backup tapes and whether the duty to preserve applies to backup tapes. So it's possible, and we've seen some people take the position that backup tapes should be stored indefinitely after a legal hold is issued. They should be taken out of rotation if there's a possibility that they contain responsive information. This is certainly the minority view, and generally we would counsel against it for active backup tapes. Instead, we tend to see more people taking the second position on the slide here, which is a more practical approach in which backup tapes are stored only for disaster recovery purposes. So there's a document management policy in place, a backup system policy in place, something of that nature that says that our backup tapes are used only for disaster recovery purposes, and they're kept in rotation in general when a legal hold comes in. And we've seen we've seen situations where even if the backup tapes could contain relevant information, the party has not been sanctioned because the backup tapes are used just for disaster recovery purposes. And the reason the courts are willing to take this position is due to the proportionality principles in Rule 26. In general, in most jurisdictions, I would say that there's a presumption, and there are cases that clearly state this, that there's a presumption that backup tapes are considered inaccessible. And they're inaccessible because the data stored for one custodian, for instance, might be stored across multiple tapes. It might not be indexed, so it's not like a hard drive that you plug in and you can search. You can process the data and search easily for a review. Instead, you have to, a lot of times, even for one custodian, upload multiple tapes, unencrypt the tapes if they're encrypted, index the files, and then you can start the process. It's very costly. One of the cases in the next slide contains a pretty detailed discussion of the inaccessibility of backup tapes, and the party states that to recover data from the backup tapes, the defendant would have to pay over $2 million. So, I mean, a lot of people, I'm sure, know this is a costly process. So we routinely see in the case law, courts accept the position that if backup tapes are only used for disaster recovery purposes, they're inaccessible, they can be kept in rotation, they can be overwritten, and production from the backup tapes is unwarranted under the proportionality doctrine. Now, this is a really well-settled area of case law. It's very well-settled in the e-discovery realm. What I think is more interesting is what we're going to start to see, which is as companies move from backup tapes to storage on disks and storage in the cloud for purposes of backups, we're going to have to watch closely whether these doctrines equally transfer over to the cloud, because unlike backup tapes, the cloud a lot of times doesn't suffer from these issues where data is stored across multiple areas. And even if data is stored across multiple areas, a lot of times the data is much more accessible. And so it'll be interesting to see if these inaccessibility doctrines apply equally to the cloud. But there are also advantages, even though we might lose the inaccessibility defense for backups to the cloud or backups to disks, there's also advantages, which is data is much more accessible. So when we go out and we do collections from custodians, instead of going to computers, Recently, we went to the cloud because the cloud had the same data, and we saved a lot of money because we were able to just pull the data off the cloud backup instead of going to each of the custodian's individual computers.
This seems like it would be a tough argument to make that the cloud is somehow inaccessible.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm just, you know, listening to Alex, what he's saying. Everything hinges on putting the cloud to the side, whether the tapes are sort of accessible or inaccessible, and that's sort of legal doctrine. But here, where you're talking about a cloud, it's just, it's really hard. I was trying to imagine a circumstance going forward where, you know, many, the company's on the phone right now, you know, some of you, most of you are using the cloud in some sense, maybe not across the board, but you're using it for some purposes. It seems hard to imagine a scenario on a going forward basis where you could argue that somehow, somewhere in the cloud, it's inaccessible. Maybe the doctrine will change a bit. I don't know, but I think you're right. There's going to be movement on that front.
When I was talking to Scott Bilbrey, who's in our litigation support services, deals with this quite often, and he's saying he was telling me that the software to access the cloud is getting better and better in terms of its search function, and so as that improves, inaccessibility is going to be less of an issue.
Going to the wayside. So we're going to turn to mobile devices. We also have a question about, you know, how BYOD issues and risks related to that, so I'm going to try to weave that into this part of the presentation. The duty to preserve, when I go out and speak in other countries, they always wonder whether the mobile devices are covered with the duty to preserve. It's a resounding yes. I think it's more common knowledge here in the United States, but abroad it's not. So mobile devices are not exempted in any way. And for our clients, for a subset of our clients, I want to say it's the most challenging issue we have going on right now, because for many of our larger clients, for instance, they might have people worldwide, sales reps worldwide doing work, and they are using their mobile devices to do all their work. So then when litigation or investigation arises, you know, all the information on the mobile devices is discoverable. So then you got to, you know, call somebody in Tokyo to get their mobile device. And so how do you do that? So do you tell them, please mail me your mobile device, and I'll mail it back to you in 2 weeks? That doesn't really work, because they're using it for their personal and work purposes. Or you try to arrange something there. I mean, it gets really, really complicated and expensive really quick. There are, third-party vendors, you know, e-discovery outfits, firms that, companies that focus only on retrieving information from mobile devices. So this is a really sort of hot topic in the sense that it's creating a lot of problems for people like you on the phone, and I don't know that there are any really good solutions to it. I want to take up this question about BYOD. So there are a lot. I'm going to take it like this. If you don't have a document management policy and you don't have a BYOD policy, and then you get dragged into a litigation, and obviously it's going to cover mobile devices, you're going to be spending a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of effort that you wouldn't normally be required to do. If you had a document management policy, even if it didn't cover the mobile devices, then you're going to have less of a headache on this front, on the retention and the preservation issues. So most of you, I would say most of you on the phone probably have some sort of document management policy. BYOD policies, which I consider to be separate, some of you companies embed the BYOD policy into the document management policy, but some have a separate BYOD policy. If you have that, and that covers preservation, litigation hold, what the protocol is going to be when you do enter litigation and you have to collect mobile devices, that's the best scenario, okay? So if you want to minimize the risk and the money you spend and the effort in your preservation relating to mobile devices, your best bet would be to have a BYOD policy that takes on these issues just head on. So then you don't have to sort of be developing policy to deal with, you know, little firestorms all throughout the world when you're trying to collect off mobile devices. I'm pausing here. I'm reading a question in the cloud environment data. So I'll come back to that. We have another question about the cloud, but I'm going to come back to that. There's also one other thing you should know about the mobile devices is there's not a court anywhere. And I'm talking state, federal, whatever level that has written off mobile devices of not being under the duty to preserve. So again, the main point is you got to collect this stuff. If you can't reach an agreement, a stipulation with the other side about not collecting it, then you should have your own house in order. And one way to get your own house in order is to have a BYOD policy. The next slide has a few case sites about what we've been talking about. You can take a look. I put these in here because I thought these were instructive, and they're also fairly recent. If you take a look at this Schaefer one, the direct quote there, the one that starts, once it is clear that a litigant, you know, this sort of demonstrates the point I was just trying to make about here are some routes you can take. You can clone the phone. You can take possession of the phone. You can print out the text. You know, if you just look at this list, none of them are very appetizing from your perspective. And this is what I mean by it's a big problem for a larger clients. And I'm not sure that we have a great solution for it. And I mean the whole industry, we're still working on this. But like I say, there are e-discovery companies now that specialize in this area. And I think that's just sort of catching up to the reality that this is such a tough issue. So we'll turn to IAM with Alex.
Okay, great. So this is our third area that's a hot topic. And I would say this has been a very hot topic in the last year. We've got a lot of questions about the preservation obligations when it comes to instant messages on enterprise or company-wide instant messaging systems. We're seeing more and more that parties are seeking discovery of instant messages. And one of the reasons I think is because, you know, employees and everyone has understood the discretion that should be used in email. And a lot of times that discretion doesn't carry over to instant messages and text messages. And so that could be a prime source for parties in discovery for information. It can be a prime source of legal risk too. Every court, similar to mobile devices, that has looked at this has said that instant messages are discoverable. So this is really something that has to be considered when assessing the duty to preserve and what needs to be preserved. But I think even earlier on, it's important to consider how a company treats its instant messages. And so there's really three ways. There's a whole spectrum, but they boil down into three ways that a company can go about treating instant messages. The first one is to prohibit them altogether and take down an enterprise or prohibit an enterprise instant messaging system. It's just impractical. A lot of these systems are already in place. They're used. They serve an important purpose. So this is a possible solution, but not an ideal one. The second solution is to store all instant messages per custodian once a duty to preserve arises. So we see companies say that once a custodian is subject to a duty to preserve, that custodian has to manually save their instant messages, or maybe the software will allow them to automatically save it, although we've only seen that, I think, once. It's sort of rare to see that. Companies will also say if a custodian is subject to a duty to preserve, that custodian is taken off of instant messaging and denied and not given access to it. Again, that's not a great solution. Where we see a lot of people landing is on this third category, which is instructing users not to use instant messages for substantive communication. So using instant messages to set up a meeting, to make lunch arrangements, that's fine. But to engage in business decisions or substantive communications about an issue is prohibited. And that positions the company well to argue once the duty to preserve arises that we didn't preserve our instant messages because we've instructed employees over in training and in other ways that they're not to use instant messages for substantive communications. We don't see employees using it for substantive communications. We had no reason to think that these instant messages contained responsive material and therefore we didn't preserve them. It's a defensible position and a good solution in a lot of instances for dealing with instant messages.
Yeah, kind of to amplify that point, this for us when we're approaching this issue. This is a very subtle and effective way to sort of shift the burden to the other side, because out of the gates, IAM is discoverable. So if there's reason to believe that there's relevant evidence in IAM form, your company is going to be expected to go out and get it. But like Alex is saying, if your background rule is that you have pounded time and again to your employees that they are not to use IAM for substance, then you, in essence, what you've done is, like Alex says, it's defensible. You just stand up and say, no, we don't. We instruct them not to use it for substance. You've really sort of shifted the burden to the other side. They're going to have to stand up before the court or, and say something like, well, you know what? Does everyone follow it? And you'd say, well, we don't have any reason to believe. Sure, we have rogue employees that probably don't follow it, but by and large, we think people follow it. We have no reason to think that they're not following it. And so we're not going to search this. Then they're basically, the other side needs to come up with an example. You know what? We know that Joe Jones and Mary Williams are using IAM for substance communications because we deposed them and they said so much. Okay. But again, if the point here is not to sort of run up your costs and your effort unnecessarily, having that background rule, it shifts the burden to the other side to stand up with affirmative evidence that gives a reason why you need to search the IAM. So again, I think that that's an approach that if you're not, it's a piece of advice that I would say, I think it, in theory it works, and I think in practice it works really well.
And to add on to that, I mean, this is a tricky issue because instant messages, you know, we talk about what instant messages, enterprise-wide instant messaging systems. I mean, there might be a formal instant messaging system. We see that, but we also see it in Skype. We see it in Outlook products. We see it in also, web meeting platforms. Any of those platforms where people are chatting back and forth, those fall into the purview of instant messages. And it's a problem. It can be a problem for custodians who are under an active legal hold if they're using those for substantive communication. And so whatever the process, once the duty to preserve arises, retention of instant messages is important. So if someone if a custodian under a duty to preserve legal hold starts to use instant messages, even in violation of company policy not to use it for substantive communications, they've got to be preserved in general.
Okay, so we are going to turn to third-party subpoenas. Before I do that, I just want to – I'm seeing these questions come up, and we cover most of them throughout as we're talking, but there's a couple that have fallen to the wayside that I just want to pick up on. One person asked about the cloud and whether there's any sort of heightened concern about spoliation of evidence in the cloud. And similarly, you know, one example cited in that chat to us was – you know, metadata could be changed in the cloud. So my sort of general response to this is that, the risk of spoliation or the risk of metadata being changed or really the risk of anything else, in my opinion nowadays, is lower in the cloud than it would be if you were not using the cloud. So it used to be 5 or 10 years ago, our clients would say, wow, we're thinking about moving to the cloud. Should we do it? We're really concerned that we're sort of relinquishing control of our information, and maybe people can hack into it and it's riskier. That, which is the tenor of that question that somebody sent by chat to us here today, that mentality has sort of gone to the wayside, because the companies that are, you know, cloud providers, that's what they do. So their business is very intent on not spoliating evidence or not changing metadata. That's the very essence of the product they're offering. So they're actually quite adept at it. I know you read things in the, you know, you read about a big hack job out in the press, but as a general matter, I think people are coming to the realization that it's actually more secure to be in the cloud than less secure. So I think that hopefully that answers that question. Another question that's sort of fallen by the wayside, and not picked up in the vein of our conversation, was somebody asked about what's an example of a wearable device. So I typically think of a watch, which aside, I don't know if you think of anything else, Alex, but that's, for me, that's the prime.
Yeah.
Prime,
I mean, we see it come up in the case law with, like Fitbits and Fitbit, electronic, yeah. You know, in personal injury cases.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to shift gears here and talk about third party subpoenas. you can imagine we get a lot of questions about third-party subpoenas just because the nature of our practice here, for all of you on the phone, sometimes you're looking to serve one, sometimes you receive one, sometimes you're party to litigation, sometimes you're not. So this comes up in many different contexts. It's a little bit different than what we've been talking about. I tend to play this conservatively, and I'll explain that in a minute, but the duty to preserve is generally triggered when the subpoena is received. So the analogy would be is if you're a party, the duty's triggered when you get the complaint. We know that's not true because you can anticipate litigation before you get the complaint. So what we're saying here is it's a more relaxed rule with the third party subpoena. You don't really have to reasonably anticipate, quote unquote. You have to receive the subpoena. Then you're under an obligation to preserve what was asked for in the subpoena. But again, I tend to play this conservatively, and I think people can come out differently on this. Despite that rule, which really is a general rule and it's in the case law, I tend to ask, I'll give you an example. We might be representing a consortium or a trade association or some other collection of clients in a certain industry. And maybe one of its members is part of a lawsuit and getting sued, and then the sort of umbrella organization wants to know, should we be retaining documents also? They're not a party to the lawsuit, and so I tend to ask, well, sort of what, have you received a subpoena? No. Well, then so the presumption is that you don't need to save any documents, but I would caution people to be a little, conservative on this front because, for instance, you could imagine you being in a situation where you haven't gotten a subpoena, but you've read every press account you've read and the three interviews on CNN the night before said you're going to get sued. You know, you haven't gotten you're going to be receiving a subpoena. You haven't gotten it yet, but you know you're going to get it. You'd want to preserve. So I think that the general rules, it's good to remember, you have more slack. You don't have to sit there and beat your head against the wall figuring out if you're in that reasonable anticipation zone. I tend to think like that anyway, but really the rule is when the subpoena is received, that's when you need to start saving. The end point on this is, you comply with the subpoena and then your duty to preserve has ended, even if the litigation's not ended. So we get questions all the time about, well, we got the subpoena, but they're not entirely happy with the production. You know, there could be motions practice. Again, the baseline rule is going to be you've sort of complied. You don't need to preserve anymore. I'm going to make a little exception to that. If you get a subpoena that, has 10 requests to it and you serve up responses to two of them and the other eight, you just say no, and there's a lot of commotion around that. You haven't really sort of, in my mind, quote unquote, complied. You wouldn't want to just lift a preservation hold. You'd want to sort of wait until that specific motion practice plays out. But when that has played out, you're done. Okay, you're not a party to litigation. You can consider yourself done. Stipulations we note here. I always like to mention this in all these contexts. If you can reach a stipulation that you're done with a party or whoever's requesting government agency, that's great. I've just found that it's hard in reality to really get a stipulation in many contexts just because people are just too far apart on the issues. The next slide, cite some cases. There's not a lot of cases on third-party subpoenas just because they're third-party subpoenas. They're not the parties. They're not really, fully involved in the litigation. So here are some that you might want to take a look at. Again, ANDRA is the second one listed here. There's no duty prior to receipt of subpoena. That is the rule. And I think that's probably news to a lot of people because a lot of people go through that same, am I in the anticipation of litigation, or am I in anticipation of subpoena? That's the mindset. I told you, I'm even in that mindset typically, so I'm a little bit conservative on this. But that's the rule, so it's a good one to know. Again, last point on this, it's really fact specific. Most of the stuff we've been talking about today is very fact specific, but we're trying to sort of give you some rules of the road that pretty much apply across the board. the end of our presentation. I think we've answered all the questions as they've come up. We will, there's a couple, one or two questions that we'll include in the slides, answers to in the slides. We want to send them out. So again, thanks for being with us today. And I encourage you, if you have a topic you want us to cover, we get these topics from you because these are for you. So just let us know what you want to hear about and we'll cover it. So thanks so much.